You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
Time for your view from the C-suite here on Classic Business, bringing you closer to South Africa's business and political economy leaders. What makes them tick? What keeps them up at night? And certainly what keeps them going in such an unprecedented environment? Well, my next guest has carved out an incredible career as a strategist, a social activist, an economist for many years at the forefront of thinking about employment in South Africa, and is now exercised about how countries become unstuck and get activated. Dr. Miriam Altman, great to have you on The View, especially at such a critical moment for not only our country, but the world. So welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I think C19 obviously sees the whole world stuck. So to talk about becoming unstuck is critical. So I look forward to discussing how we get unstuck and reactivated from this global socioeconomic crisis later. But I want to go back in time a little to your early years. You acquired a BA in economics from McGill University, an MPhil, one of the most respected universities on the planet, from Cambridge, and a PhD in economics from the University of Manchester. And you've clearly drawn from your academic wellspring over your career. You're a prodigious researcher. I just want to understand what led you into the field of social activism through that lens of your academic research and background, and bringing that to bear in the field of activism in South Africa.
I've spent my life in between doing research and doing, and applying the two together. So I probably more started as an activist and in development work, and have interspersed with my graduate education, and always have interspersed the two.
And one might say, I think in South Africa, we've got almost too many diagnostics of the problem, and really what we need is more doing. As you mentioned, we need more implementation. How does one bridge the necessary need for evidence-based policymaking, which we're heading back towards, thankfully, under the new administration, with action, with doing?
Well, the first thing is you have to care about it, you know, and it's felt for quite a long time that evidence-based thinking has not been that important. When I was at HSRC years ago, we had a process called evidence-based employment scenarios that ran for about a decade. And we had top leaders from business, labor, and government with us for about a decade. And I mean top CEOs, really top echelon leaders of the country were with us for about a decade and really wanted to get that information. I'm finding now, as you say, under COVID, what's very interesting is that there's a real hunger for new ideas, a new openness across the board in government anyway, to get ideas. What I've been writing about lately, though, and even my work in the National Planning Commission, I've been writing a lot for Maverick over the course of the past year, about why we want to move forward, but somehow we don't. We keep reverting back to old behavior. I think we're even seeing it now and it's something I'm writing about right now, the manifestation of how township lockdowns are happening, mm-hmm. as compared to what's happening in the suburbs. It speaks to an historical behavior that I think we would struggle to admit. For example, the thought that you would lock people into homes, that you would beat people, that you would shut the informal sector down and limit them to fruit and vegetables, and they require a new permit, they've got to go stand in line, and there's no office that's open, right? That's, you know, in the 1980s, there used to be a list if you were a township trader, you could have one store and you could sell soap, and you could, you know, there was a list of about eight things or so that you were allowed to sell, and that was it. You weren't allowed to have a factory and so on. So I think we struggle to admit how difficult it's been to shake off that kind of behavior. That's something I've been writing about. You know, when I talk about being stuck, when you have unemployment that has lasted for so long, in other words, African unemployment has been high since the late 1970s.
Yep.
Per capita growth has been slow for the past at least 50 years. It means you have some behavioral problem. And it's occurred to me that I'm trained in economics, and I know there's a thing called behavioral economics, but I'm trying to translate what is it about our behavior that makes us stuck. Like, we wish, for example, that we were a developed country. And the way we're doing this lockdown is as if we're a developed country. But in fact, most people do not live in that way. And what I'm most concerned about now, I mean, we're leaping around, but what I'm literally writing about it. I'm going to put out a paper tonight, and we've been engaging with the presidency and the treasury around this, is I think our number one economic risk right now with COVID is not the stuff people are talking about. I think the number one problem is we're going to go through a lockdown. It's going to do an enormous amount of damage that we couldn't afford in the first place, because firms were already on tenterhooks with sort of 10 years of decline. And because of the way the townships are being managed, and frankly, even the suburbs, that we'll end up in another lockdown by June. Unless we take these next 2 weeks seriously. And when I say seriously, what I mean is, I was at the Rosebank Woolworths, and you know that the neighborhood where you and I live is the epicenter of where the infections are, actually.
Yeah, if you look at
the GMA. There was a long snaking line in Woolworths, right? I've tried to buy food online. I can't do it. So I have to go to the store. You look at the townships, and you're telling people to stay in a shack for 21 days. It's physically impossible to do that. It just is impossible, because you share taps, you share toilets, in fact, staying in a shack would make you sick.
Isn't that the big concern with the way we've approached the lockdown, though? It does seem to be, and I think very often there could be the same critique about some of the regulation and legislation we introduce. It does seem to be copy and pasted from environments, developed markets that are significantly different to the environmental, ecological reality of South Africa today. So how do we tailor the lockdown to South African circumstances then? Because there's also a lot of incongruency in the regulations. I mean, a lot of people saying, well, we don't quite understand why you would stop a Woolworths, to use that example. It seems a very middle-class issue on Twitter, but why you would stop selling prepared meals and chicken when you can still sell other prepared dried foodstuffs. There's a lot of incongruency. And if you don't have public buy-in, well, as we've seen, I've noticed today alone, it's day one of the second phase, a lot more traffic out there. Now, I'm a journalist, we're essential service, so we're allowed to drive to and from the office, and there's a marked increase in traffic. It doesn't look like the public is buying in anymore.
Well, also, just in terms of economic logic, why not let people buy anything online? Because, you know, then companies will start drawing down on their inventories, they'll earn revenue. There's plenty of opportunities. I know the Uber executives here have been trying to get opportunity to for their drivers to deliver anything. And there are a lot of limitations. Now, I think that the state, to be fair, is trying to wrap its head around how to do this and has had to act quickly. But equally, I think that there's a long history of security orientation. The control, in the old days with the Group Areas Act, you know, they said, if you, I quote this in my thesis, you know, if you let people just look for jobs, there'll be chaos, was how people thought about it in those days, you know, in the 70s and 80s. So there's a bit of a security orientation, and this thing is dominated by security orientation. But in fact, what you need is a more partnership between the police and communities to work out. So, you know, what is a household in a township? Now, that's going to vary, but it may be that you've got tenants and you have different family members. And, you know, so what would be the demarcation of a household? A township dweller also isn't going to have stock. So what if your shoes rip up? What if you need a light bulb? You know, which things are, someone was giving an example today of what if, you know, you have a baby and you have a kettle and the kettle breaks. You know, or your stove breaks or something like that. So I think that they're trying to be careful around security, but we are going to have to treat the second half of this lockdown very differently.
I was chatting to Ricardo Hausmann a couple of weeks ago, and he's very mindful of the different circumstances in developing emerging markets versus developed economies. We don't have the fiscal headroom to just drop helicopter money down and support households that way. There's a lot of talk about how do we reach the indigent and the poorest in South Africa? Do we increase various grants that are already going out and being distributed through those channels? But there's also a mindfulness that we can't lock down for as long as a developed market without suffering serious economic ramifications, which will impact not just on livelihoods, but will also impact on lives at the end of the day. So it's an unenviable trade-off and balancing act that the government is trying to walk at the moment. And I don't want to be overly judgmental, because it is a hard path to walk, but there is a lot of damage. Miriam, I speak to a lot of small businesses at the moment, a lot of damage being done to the small and particularly the micro traders in the township. How do we change tack to try and support them?
The president has taken that on. In his latest announcement, he talked about the lockdown would end at the end of the month, and then we would go into risk-adjusted strategies. Many of us were sharing this document. It was written by a German research outfit called IFO. And they speak to the balance between health and economics, knowing that we're probably in this till the end of the year. So we need a sustainable approach, which is what they help you think through. You've got to have something that you can sustain for the next 6-8 months, maybe even longer, as we go through this, which means you can't shut your economy down for a whole year. So the idea is the lockdown for South Africa probably was important and that we acted very quickly. What I'm saying is we need to do this lockdown properly now, because it isn't actually a lockdown if you think about it. And then you go into risk-based strategies, which then say ubiquitous testing or testing at a much bigger scale and faster results gotten, yeah. Of course.
Yeah.
Isolating people when you find people who are ill, and for townships that means you probably need what some people call health sanctuaries, and I think the state is looking at that. There are a range of strategies that can be adopted, and where you have certain areas, you can have area lockdowns rather than the whole country. In the paper that I'll release tonight, I also propose strategies around education. You could be running schools at 50% and maybe just running math classes and the kinds of stuff that kids fall behind on. You know, reading, they don't fall behind on in the same way as they do on math. You can have teachers rotating between high school classes rather than kids doing so. Because, you know, what we're going to do, and this is the theme of the paper that I'll put out today, is that we've fallen so far behind already on employment and inequality and poverty in this country over the past decade. After having made progress, we've fallen behind. We can't just take the answers when people say, shut education down for the year. I see that almost, people speak about that almost like it's true. I say, no, people, you have to try. Maybe it's true, but you know, it is just unrealistic to think.
On that point, Miriam, I had Professor Jonathan Janssen on my show this week calling for that very thing. And it elicited a flurry of responses either way. But the one issue I have seen today come into my inbox is from the various trade unions, SATU amongst them, having a look at this proposal to go back into a phased approach of reintroducing learners at different stages, different phases. Their major concern seems to be centered around those schools where they're up to 60 children in a class. And what happens then for physical distancing purposes is you have to split that up to maybe two, maybe three classes. So you've got 20 and no more in a class. How do we do that? Do we have the resources to even do that? I mean, there's some serious practical and operational challenges in all of this.
Well, you know, this is where we have to put on our creative thinking caps, you know, and I'm not joking, because, you know, we have to figure something out. And so some of the a guy who advises the Department of Basic Education and has written a very nice paper, he's also an academic at Stellenbosch, his name is Martin Gustafsson, has written about this. And just as examples, you might not have every subject taught in school. You might say, let's focus on the subjects that, you know, where you have a buildup, like math. One thing always leads to another. Reading is a little different, you see. You can do reading at home and whatever. But when you're doing math or physical science, you really need to be in school and you really need to go progress through. So you might teach fewer subjects in school, and at least the kids, and then you have fewer kids, they might rotate the days that they come. 75% of kids, by the way, walk to school, so they're safe.
Yeah.
Right? So 25% of kids need to get sorted out on maybe school busing. You don't want those kids to go home if there's an elderly person in the house. So either those kids who have an elderly person at the house have to sleep somewhere else, and the hotels are empty, by the way, or the older people need to get isolated, which is something that Ricardo Hausmann suggests. I don't know if those things are plausible, but we have to try.
I agree with that spirit of innovation. And one thing that has struck me, Miriam, is there is a new sense of collaboration. And it was present during Ramaphosa 1. It had kind of waned. One got a sense that business was growing a little bit frustrated with the slow pace of reforms. Perhaps the expectations didn't fully take into account the political minefield with which the president has to navigate. That said, this new crisis, it's amazing. South Africans do tend to rally around. We perform best when we're looking over the precipice, as Bobby Godsell loves to remind us. But this new crisis really has brought business a lot closer to government at this stage. So there is an opportunity to collaborate and find these kinds of creative solutions. Are you confident that this administration, you mentioned talking to the presidency, is open to that kind of collaboration across the board, while some in the cabinet seem to be using this opportunity in a very securocratic way to be diplomatic?
Well, yeah, there is a very securocratic kind of approach, which is what I was referring to earlier. But there's no doubt that there has been, a groundswell of support, activity. People must be aware of the BUSA, or I'm not sure what the BSA, but Business for South Africa.
For South Africa, yeah.
Yeah. So the BSA initiative is, and I'm very active in their groups, is moving at a pace, and there's been fantastic connection with government. So there's no doubt that it certainly has rallied people around.
So people are rallied. We know we have to be creative. Now we need to create the fiscal headroom. And there's still a lot of debate internally inside the ruling party as to how we go about doing that. There is a huge resistance to approaching the IMF because of the connotations around structural adjustment programs, and those seem to be rather archaic. If you look at what's on the table now, as far as I understand it, the IMF is not offering anything with nearly the kinds of strings and conditions attached to help emerging markets in particular create this fiscal headroom. How do we create enough fiscal headroom, and what would be enough? I've seen a figure of around 250 billion.
The first thing is that people shouldn't underestimate how hard it is to approach the IMF. I think people think that the IMF is scoping around trying to pick up countries so it can drop its structural adjustment program. It actually is not that easy to approach the IMF. In Africa, South Africa would probably be front of the line just because of, its role in the continent. But it's actually not an easy project to get IMF help, is the first thing. The second thing is, as you rightly point out, the multilaterals and including the Bretton Woods institutions like the World Bank and the IMF, they don't do that structural adjustment story anymore. They don't have that kind of hegemony of thinking and of power anymore. They compete now. So the first thing is that we still have the New Development Bank to approach. We have the CRA, which is a BRICS, a BRICS facility. If I'm not mistaken, I think $20 billion might be available there. I stand under correction, but something like that. AFDB, we hardly get money from them right now. AFDB has raised enormous amounts of money very quickly in the past month for this kind of purpose, for low-cost finance.
Yeah.
The range of other options, and then there's the IMF support and the World Bank. I think we're going to have to find the lowest cost source of finance. One of the problems in fiscal policy in the past period of years, and I think it's just been politic, has been that government raises funds in a fairly expensive way and has not been going to the multilateral banks, that amongst the ones I've just mentioned, for whatever reason. You know, but now the dollar's expensive and the rand is cheap. That makes it a good time to go. If you see what I mean, because it hopefully would revert. You know, if you have an Argentina story where the dollar is cheap and your currency is expensive and then it goes south, then you're really in trouble, which is what happened in Argentina. Hopefully for us, it would go in the other direction. And then also what you do is you link it to expenditure in dollar. You buy stuff in dollars using that money. So, but anyway, what I've done is I've... a little bit of a punt, you know, it's a punt where it's Tuma Mina work. A group of us, of economists, some former Treasury guys, you know, all of us have had public policy background, came together just before the lockdown and have gone Zoom crazy like everybody else. And
sucked into the vortex.
Well, we decided that, you know, our Tuma Mina contribution was that we would start putting shoulder to the wheel to start thinking about how, firstly, you understand this period, because nobody knows what it's about. Not even China knows how it's going to land.
Yeah.
And secondly, what to do. So we have a range of proposals that we've been working on and working very closely with Treasury on. So we have work that was just, in fact, Carol Payton wrote about it in the Business Day today. It was the front page story. Yeah. So two of the projects that we are working on was a front page story. One is a macro fiscal strategy to deal with the kinds of things that you're talking about. We have a proposal around a COVID bond, a social impact bond, bridging finance facility, you know, for loan guarantees basically via the Reserve Bank. I've produced a wage support that would take the UIF idea and channel it through revenue services instead.
Yeah, because clearly UIF can't administer the payouts. Anyone who's ever had to deal with UIF, my ex-wife, when she was pregnant, had to have the unfortunate displeasure of dealing with UIF. It took around 7 months to get that payment out. She was back at work already. We know they don't have the administrative capacity. Those proposals, saw them in the Business Day today, clearly are more medium term though in nature. If you look at the COVID bond in structuring that, it's not easy to do. Would you say that's near term?
We are moving fast. I mean, the way that we look, we've been putting shoulder to the wheel for the past 3 weeks. You know, it's been. You can see my hair's out of place. we've been working harder. You know, pretty hard actually. And we're doing it independently because I think and government leaders in Treasury, presidency, and so on have actually asked us to do it this way because it makes us nimble.
Yeah.
So it doesn't mean that what we're proposing or the frame of what we're proposing will be adopted, but we've had a chance to put together with people who know where the money is, how to mobilize it, you know, how to physically do it. And so the group that I assembled to begin with is all a group of people who know how the mechanisms work. They're economists, but they also, like I say, former head of the budget office, that's Michael Sachs,
yeah,
Andrew Donaldson, these types of people. So, we have some thinking pieces, like the one that I'll put out tonight, but we've been focusing on what we would see as high impact, immediate actions that can be done straight away through existing channels. So on the COVID bond, we have assembled a team of, pro bono help.
Yeah.
From legal, you know, anything that needs to happen. The state just has to decide that it wants to move forward on the idea. So we've put everything in place, the idea, the people power to do it, et cetera. And actually, we need to move quickly because the view, this is Stuart Theobald from Intellidex, who I'm sure you know. So he's part of our group. And he's the one who's prepared this proposal and has brought a team around, and he's ready to go as soon as the button is pressed.
Well, that's the last point because we have run out of time. Maria, a lot of people were hoping to see or hear something from Wednesday's cabinet meeting. The fact that we didn't, Carol Payton wrote about that as well, the fact that the can was sort of kicked down the road. Is that because of these presentations? Are we expecting and hoping to hear something on the fiscal package as early as next week? Because this is urgent. I'll read you some of the emails that I'm receiving from people on the ground who are independent contractors, who the one man's a 50-year-old paramedic, lost his wife 6 years ago. That financially wiped him out, so he can't get UIF. He's not BEE compliant, so he slips through the cracks everywhere, and he's desperate. Your heart bleeds. You get a stream, an avalanche of these emails coming in. The situation is absolutely urgent.
No, you're absolutely right. And that's why certainly our group got moving and government is moving at a pace as well. I can't explain what happened in the cabinet meeting, but I do hope that in their meeting early next week that that they will actually make these announcements. I think the president certainly knows. And I just wanted to say before we sign off, we've put together a website. This is all Tumamina, hey? We're all putting in our time to contribute to this. We just threw in our time. So we've set up a website where we're organizing all of our papers and ultimately we'll be posting other interesting stuff as well.
Oh, fantastic.
And it's called COVID-19economicideas.org.
COVID-19economicideas.org. I just wanted to repeat it there. And what I'll be doing is tweeting that out with this podcast later tonight as well, Miriam.
And it's just our contribution. We hope that it's useful and we hope people will use it and it'll go live tomorrow.
Well, all I can say is that I'm encouraged by the amount of energy that this crisis has unlocked from the likes of yourself and Michael Sachs and Andrew Donaldson and Peter Attard, Montalto and Shirt Theobald, all of those individuals who are really concerned and who are putting their shoulder to the wheel. I'm just disappointed we didn't have more time, but that's the stricture of radio, unfortunately, Miriam. Otherwise, we could carry on forever. But I'll let you get back to your work. It's been a great pleasure sharing a little insight into your journey and what you're engaged in now with this C-19 project. Thanks for your time.